for this this session, and looks like we have a good amount of people in the audience. As Joe mentioned, my name is Tim Heuer. I'm one of the community program managers for the Silverlight team. My contact information is up on the live meeting now, and I believe this slide deck will be made available as well, so you can retrieve this contact information at any time. I really appreciate people being able to ask questions. So, as Joe mentioned, both of us are going to be kind of keeping one eye on the Q&A panel. So please, if you have questions, please use the Q&A manager pane and submit your question. I think, as a note here, I think interactivity benefits us all. You know, I learned something, and hopefully other people learn something as well. And I also can understand the value of getting your question answered in the context of the discussion that's happening at the moment. So we'll do our best to monitor the questions and answer them as they come in. If your question is kind of specific, though, or if it's kind of a debug question, feel free to send me a note privately. My email's there on the slide deck, so feel free to do that. I'll do my best to respond as quickly as possible. Otherwise, just go ahead and submit the question during this live meeting. So the discussion today is going to be talking about Silverlight from an architect's perspective. And I think what's interesting to note is as we start talking about Silverlight and WPF as well, I think it's interesting to see this shift over the past few years, you know, maybe 3 to 5 years of this client revival that I'm seeing. My background is actually completely in web development coming to Silverlight, and maybe it's through those jaded eyes that I say this, but I do believe that more and more organizations and even some public-facing consumer sites are looking to develop a client experience for their customers. And those customers may be you and me as consumers of a brand product or customers of employees of an organization. And in this client revival, I think we have two classes of applications that we'll talk about. And the concepts that I'll be discussing here really apply to both of them, although we'll be talking about Silverlight specifically. We have this notion that's been around for quite some time, this concept that we call rich client applications. And a rich client application we can think of as, you know, something that the user is going to install on their desktop, something that you as an architect and as a developer and as an IT manager perhaps have to understand the impact to the desktop. There's deployment concerns that you have to understand, you know, authentication on the desktop, user rights on the desktop. Again, so these are applications that are full trust applications sitting on the desktop, you know, user installed or IT deployed or something like that. From an architect perspective, these represent the richest possible applications that we can deliver. We have the full benefit of the hardware of the machine they're running on. We have a full trust environment that we know that we're going to exist on. Of course, full trust meaning up to the permissions of the user on their machine. We have usually a very rich presentation layer to be able to deliver that with, whether that's WinForms or even the richest presentation layer in Windows Presentation Foundation or WPF. We have those benefits to us, hardware acceleration, 3D modeling for certain decision analysis or perhaps you know, some type of CAD application. We also have, usually in rich client applications, have the benefit of having much more of a connected architecture between our data source and our services usually. That's not always the case, but it is typically the case that we can be a little bit more stateful in the connection between our data. We usually see a very distinct separation of these layers, as you can see on the screen here, you know, a presentation layer, a business layer, some type of data layer, and perhaps within a rich client application, some offline capabilities leveraging local data sources as well. So in the past couple years, we've seen this shift to, or I should say evolution of this term rich client applications evolve to this, you know, the latest buzzword, rich internet applications, or RIAs, as you'll probably see it more referenced. And really, if we look at the difference between the two concepts of a rich client application and a rich internet application, The only difference really at the core level is where the application is executed. If we look at this diagram here that's on the screen, we can see that our client is now, in fact, the browser, essentially, and the execution layer is within usually plugin models. Now, I would argue that rich internet applications are also DHTML applications or AJAX applications is another way to think of it. But for the context of our discussion, and usually when you're talking to folks in the industry about RIAs, it's really in the context of a rich client platform, whether that's Silverlight, whether that's Flash or Flex or JavaFX or Java Applets or ActiveX for that matter. It's usually in the context of some type of plugin execution model. And the funny thing is that nothing from an architectural standpoint really changes of how we think we should architect applications and how we think about the security layers in between. And the challenges now become things like a stateless environment, the sandbox model of browsers, so we're no longer in a full trust environment. And our data sources are not directly exposed to our clients. So these are some of the things that we have to think about in a rich internet application. But that's what the context that we'll be discussing a little bit today. So one thing to kind of take a step back for those who may not be familiar with, let's take just a quick step back and see, what is Silverlight and or WPF. And I usually couple these discussions a little bit together, Silverlight and WPF, and kind of refer to it as XAML development platforms. The things that you'll have to understand from an architectural standpoint of developing and constructing an application are very, very similar. So what is Silverlight? What is WPF? Well, it's really two things. It's a presentation point platform, which is based on what we call XAML, which is short for the Extensible Application Markup Language. Really, what XAML is at the core of the Windows Presentation Foundation. It's a language that it is XML. It's an XML document and specification. We actually published the specification for XAML if you want to build tools around it, et cetera. But it's an XML representation of the user interface, both in not just the user interface, but as well as behavior at times of describing the user interface. So instead of having some, lines of C++ or C# code that constructs a simple button, you basically have angle bracket button that defines that. So it's much more human readable from a user interface standpoint, as well as enables us from a platform standpoint to develop these rich internet experiences. The second aspect of Silverlight and WPF is that it is the .NET framework. Now, this is where we kind of see some of the differences. So the .NET framework has existed for years now. It's evolved to become a first-class application development framework, both on the server and on the client. And we're now seeing the benefits of the evolution of the presentation platform of WPF. So in WPF, we say that the .NET framework is there. We have the full .NET framework capabilities to us. So we do have a complete dependency on the framework being installed for our application to run. And so this is kind of the evolution of traditional Windows Forms applications. And WPF provides us that XAML development environment to develop those rich client experiences on the desktop. But keep in mind that it does require the full .NET framework dependency on the machine. So WPF essentially is a Windows-only technology. Silverlight, in contrast, is basically the same CLR, so the same common language runtime, but not the full base class libraries. So what we get out of that is we get the benefit of writing managed code and writing C# Visual Basic, writing .NET code that is going to execute in the browser. And now we don't have the full base class libraries available to us, so that's something to be considered. But at the core, it is the same CLR that's executing. Now, Silverlight introduces a couple things. Because we are a browser plugin, we are able to basically be cross-platform and cross-browser, and we operate in the browser. So those are the key differences from WPF and Silverlight. Is right now, Silverlight is a cross-platform browser plugin and platform, and what we mean by cross-platform for us is Windows and OS X, We actually do have a cross-platform story on Linux provided through the Moonlight project, which is a project by Novell that we assist with from time to time. From a presentation standpoint, Silverlight is a subset of the XAML, so it's not the full XAML specification from WPF, and it's also, as I mentioned, a subset of the base class libraries. So you might be asking yourself, okay, you know, given that these things are very close together, you know, how do you make decisions of, you know, I want to develop a rich application, and you know, whether you call it a rich client application or a rich internet application, you know, how do I go about picking my battle and choosing the platform? And these are some of the things that you might be considered from an architect standpoint is, you know, what is your audience? What is your deployment model? What is the user experience that you're trying to go after? You know, from, is it the line of business application that's behind the firewall? Is it a public-facing application that's an extension to some of your products or peripherals that your company may be developing? What's the web infrastructure? You know, are you building it on services, or is there a much more of a coupled model to your data sources? Do you have needs of the client processing power? So is this a CAD type program where you're going to need the benefit of a higher CPU and a higher GPU to be able to do much more graphic intensive processing? Gaming is a perfect example usually in this model. You know, what is the security model that you have to understand as far as, you know, can't you do certain things within the certain user rights? And then understanding some of the complexity of your user interface, as well as understanding the obvious decisions of, given your chosen platform, you know, what if the platform's not there? Then what do you do? So I usually, when people ask me about, you know, Silverlight versus WPF, and, you know, what choices that we should make and how you make those particular choices, for me, I think that when you have a known platform and your platform is Windows and you control that environment, WPF should be your first choice. And it might sound odd for me to say that as a Silverlight PM and, you know, during a discussion about Silverlight, but you really should be looking from a client development standpoint, you know, find ways to not choose WPF first, at least as we currently stand right now, especially if you're behind the firewall, your target is Windows, and you control that platform, you're going to get the richest capabilities out of WPF. And then take a look at these, you know, these particular items here and understand, you know, mitigate your risk of, okay, now where does Silverlight perhaps fit better in that decision making. So some core scenarios where Silverlight works very well for is, and these are just some samples and some customer examples as well. Number one is media. If you're doing any type of media delivered from a browser experience, both internally, perhaps you're doing online training, and at Microsoft we have tons of online training that's all delivered via video and transcripts and surveys that are synced up to the video. Media is one of Silverlight's hugest strong points, and in fact, when we released Silverlight 1.0, media was really the only story at that point. You could do other things, but the strongest suit was media. And you can see that some of our customers implementing this is NBC Sports has been leveraging Silverlight for Sunday Night Football, as well as Wimbledon and some other sports events, providing a live, smooth streaming capability playback for consumers, not just for internally, but for consumers. Netflix, one of the most popular movie companies, delivering DVD rentals both online as well as via mail order in the United States, uses Silverlight for their playback mechanism in Windows Media Center, as well as through what they call their Instant Watch capabilities, which is available on Mac and Windows platforms if you're a consumer. And Netflix has chosen Silverlight because of the capabilities of the media platform to be able to deliver this adaptive streaming concept in combination with their custom rights management capabilities that they have to ensure the movie producers that they're following. And then some other customers, like the Ultimate Fighting Championship, recently displayed one of their pay-per-view sites using Silverlight in one of their last events. Another scenario that is a casual gaming, and you'll see that on the public facing side of things, casual gaming is actually pretty huge, and I'm sure some IT managers wouldn't like to hear that their employees are playing games during the day, but the fact is that some of the largest online properties are in fact casual gaming properties, and these are becoming huge monetization endpoints for organizations to tap into. Facebook is actually one that I didn't even include here, but you can consider Facebook a casual gaming platform. Miniclip is the largest casual gaming platform in the online world, and they have some Silverlight games as well as some Flash games. MSN games is another example. But Silverlight is a great platform for casual gaming. And then the last, probably most interesting bucket to this group is the traditional line of business applications. So if you have applications that are more what I call, I don't really like the term line of business. I think if your Miniclip, your line of business application, is a game, so it's hard to really, I think it's a gray term for me, but that's why I like to call it maybe perhaps traditional line of business. So these are heavy data access, back office support applications, very heavy forms usage, you know, an IRS tax form, you know, payroll implementations, any type of, you know, HR employee management application, these types of things. So this is also what Silverlight is capable for as well. There are some things, however, that you probably don't want to use Silverlight for, and perhaps these things will change as the platform evolves, but this is appropriate for Silverlight 3 discussion, is, you know, there are some places where Silverlight just simply can't operate without significant impact to your development platform. One example is if your application needs to have access to physical device peripherals. So if you're you know, a medical imaging application where you need to interoperate with scanners, perhaps it's an ATM financial institution, or if you've ever gone to a modern airport recently where you actually go to the kiosk and you're interfacing with you know, credit card systems and printers and things like that. While it may sound great from a deployment standpoint to have Silverlight as your mechanism of a rich client deployed via the web, these type of things may start introducing some challenges in your development platform. In addition, some embedded scenarios might not be a great choice as well. And I often see people, we actually get questions quite a bit on the forums and even directly about individuals trying to say, you know, How do I interoperate with my company's, you know, printing mechanism or scanner or something like that, and I want to use Silverlight? Well, right now Silverlight operates in a secure sandbox in the browser, so you don't have access to those local device peripherals. And then usually the conversation then goes into an architecture that involves creating a Windows service that exposes a WCF endpoint to kind of broker the communication between this device peripheral. I think that's when, if you start doing those type of architectures and you've just immediately added a dependency to your application, and you've also just told me that it's a Windows-only platform because you're saying Windows service, those are the type of things where you need to start thinking, is Silverlight in fact the right platform for this job at this time? So really understand the architecture of your application. Again, kind of just to reiterate, you know, what do I choose, WPF or Silverlight? You know, I mentioned this before. If your platform is known, if the platform is Windows and you control that environment, it's definitely something to look at WPF first. Understanding things of like who is your audience and where is your audience will also help impact your decision of which XAML platform you choose to go. You know, if reach and breadth is key to your development, then perhaps Silverlight is the choice. You know, not being able to have the dependency on the full .NET framework, but you are taking a dependency on the plugin existing as well. And what is the life and the application, you know, kind of the growth of the roadmap of your application? You know, some of you that might be in organizations that are, you know, defense contractors, your applications may have a huge lifetime, you know, 5 to 7 years where things, it's very hard to get applications to change, and you know, perhaps you're in a different environment where your organization is much more agile and your applications change year over year. So understanding the, you know, the deployment models as well is something that you should really understand and take a broad look at your application for determining which is the correct platform choice there. So given that, let's talk about if choosing Silverlight. So let's assume now that the choice has been made to choose Silverlight. You know, how would you go about looking at Silverlight as a platform and architecting the application? And I think I put up these seven kind of buckets of key things that I think that you as an architect and as a developer need to understand as far as going into XAML development in the Silverlight world. So these are understanding deployment, understanding where your application logic is going to exist, what does partitioning mean as far as segmenting the application, how are you communicating with data or other types of endpoints, where is your data, what type of data is it, what are the security implications of your application, and then also the user experience. Now, those of you who are user experience experts might kind of look at me as putting user experience last, and these are actually in no particular order. I think these are all at the same level of importance, and perhaps user experience is one of the most important. It's interesting that people will make an investment so much in the development of their application, but if it's something that the users can't use effectively, that investment is essentially lost. And so I'll talk about some points on user experience as well. So let's drill into a couple of these. From a deployment standpoint, and again, this is kind of echoing some of the things that I mentioned before, these are some of the questions perhaps that you have to ask yourself of, you know, is Silverlight the right choice? And once you've made that, you know, do you know what your deployment mechanism is going to be? Do you have a known platform? Do you control the platform? Those are two things I mentioned before. Even in the Silverlight world, these are important to understand. While Silverlight is a rich internet browser plugin, and it is cross-browser and cross-platform, knowing the platform and controlling the platform are still two very important things that you should know in your application lifecycle or in your development lifecycle. If you control the platform, you know, behind the firewall, you're more likely to understand the next two bullet points, actually, the permissions of the user that might be executing the application, as well as guaranteeing that the plugin exists. And when we look at the plugin existing is probably the biggest bullet point on deployment that application developers have to understand here. And before I talk about that, let me talk about application updates as well. If you are deploying a Silverlight application, you know, what is going to be your update mechanism? If you're using things like isolated storage for dependencies of configuration data, et cetera, how are you planning on updating and versioning that information? Using features like Silverlight's out-of-browser technique, have you planned for the application updates the second the user has installed it on their desktop? Those are, again, things that you have to think about in advance, especially the out-of-browser scenario. If you haven't planned for application updates and you didn't build that logic in at the very, very beginning and the user installs that Silverlight application, you've just lost them for the update immediately. So that's one step. I actually wish in Visual Studio there was a file new Silverlight out-of-browser application that actually included some of that logic there. But let's talk also about the plugin existing, because I think this has a twist on optimizing the user experience as well. And so I often talk about the installation experience. And a good example, and this is in the U.S. as well, so for those of you who may be joining us internationally, you probably have not seen this. But Netflix is a great example and a great demonstration on forethought in the application for users who don't have the plugin. If I was a Netflix subscriber and I went to the Instant Watch, I went to go watch the movie Lean on Me, and I didn't have Silverlight installed, this is what would be presented to me. This represents incredible forethought from Netflix to present, hey, you're about to watch this movie Lean on Me. You know, there's the DVD cover. Here's some information, you know, about the movie, a giant call to action button of install now, and really kind of still making it known that you're installing a Microsoft Silverlight plugin. Again, using words like it only takes a minute, so assisting the user to help them understand the impact of the action they're about to do. But this is really, really probably the best example of an experience that I have of, you know, the plugin not existing and the developers taking the time to make sure that they're providing enough information to me, the end user, that I can make a decision that this content is valuable enough for me to go to the next step. In stark contrast, this is what you normally see in most applications. And this is install Microsoft Silverlight means nothing to my mother-in-law who just went to, whatever financial information site or anything. This is something that I absolutely hate to see, and raising our hand here, pointing our finger at Microsoft, we are in fact guilty of this as well in some of the sites that we build as we outsource to vendors. But this does nothing to your user experience. So I'd like to just point out the difference between the optimal experience and the not even thought about experience. And the important is what I mentioned briefly earlier, is that you're about to embark on this investment in both human resources and financial resources to architect and build the best application you can for your organization. But if people can't even get to it and they see no value in it, your investment is completely lost. Your ROI is zero. And so it's really important to take that time and put that work item on your task to say, okay, especially if you don't control the platform, if we are developing something online, what is that not installed experience? Now, for Silverlight, we're last week at the Professional Developers Conference in LA, we announced that we're at about 45% penetration worldwide for plug-in installation. So there still is some opportunity there for us to assist our developers in making sure that the plugin is on as many platforms as possible. But just be wary of that and make sure that you don't have this as your experience, especially in a public-facing install. We actually have guidance on this. I think at the end of the slide deck I have a link to a white paper that has complete sample code on helping you basically build this experience, the completely optimized experience, versus just using the default template. So understanding what your business logic is and what type of information that you're doing is also key to creating a good Silverlight application. These are some of the things that I think are top of mind where you have to consider. First of all, are you communicating any type of sensitive information? Is this a financial application where you're transmitting account numbers or personally identifiable information, or PII? Where are you storing that information? How is that sensitive information being communicated across the wire? These are types of things that, where is the business logic for this type of information? Also, in most traditional line of business applications, we have a rules engine typically. In some of your applications, we have, some people might use Windows Workflow Foundation, for example. Is your rules on the server, is your rules engine on the client? Understanding where your rules engine and your logic might be. I see a quick question about the 45% penetration. The question is, of the 45% penetration, what's the breakdown between version 1, 2, and 3? I actually don't have that breakdown of numbers as far as what version. But it's a good question in that I wanted to I should have pointed out that once the Silverlight plugin is installed on a user's machine, there is an auto update mechanism for the plugin itself. So on Windows, we show preference to Microsoft Update System, but we also have a fallback mechanism to there is an update mechanism itself in the plugin. On OS X, again, we use that kind of update mechanism on the plugin for the OS X platform as well. So if a user has a Silverlight 2 installed and they have the auto update enabled, which is the default option, most likely they've already been upgraded to Silverlight 3 in the release version. And so we kind of throttle that. So as we release a new version of Silverlight, we don't immediately turn on that auto update mechanism. We kind of throttle that over time to make sure that users aren't directly impacted, our servers aren't immediately loaded, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully that answers your question. Continuing on the business logic, again, so understanding where that rules engine is going to exist and where that logic is going to execute is something that you need to consider as well. Additionally, temporary storage solutions. So maybe your RIA application is an online, offline application where you have, any of the traveling salesman scenarios where, I have a trip report, an expense report, a sales order that, I'm doing customer information while I'm connected, and I disconnect and I'm going to, my sales meeting and I'm processing an order there while I'm disconnected. What is your temporary storage solution mechanism and what are your needs there? For Silverlight, we do provide an isolated storage mechanism, and it is the same isolated storage that exists in the full .NET framework. So if you use that, if you're familiar with those APIs, you're able to use those. By default, every Silverlight application has the capability of using up to 1 megabyte of isolated storage from an in-browser experience. And from an out-of-browser experience, that default changes to 25 megabytes. Now, those are not hard limits. The hard limit is basically the size of the hard drive. Those are the kind of low ceiling limits. And you as a developer have the option to request the end user to allow more storage to be used. That is a user-controlled action. So if I'm operating in the browser and I need to write a 2 megabyte configuration file of some sort, I would have to request permission to the user to say, will you allow me to increase the storage limit to X megabyte and operate and store that information. The great thing about the isolated storage from an in-browser and out-of-browser standpoint, they both use the exact same storage location. So you don't have to suddenly switch logic if your application goes out-of-browser. It is the same physical location on the user's machine. But understanding that it is temporary storage, isolated storage is not a permanent storage mechanism. So a lot of people tend to think that it is and start using it for more kind of permanency of data. The user is in complete control of isolated storage. It is pretty obfuscated as far as the path of the storage, and most people will not, average end users will not be deleting their isolated storage information on a regular basis, but understand that the control is in the hands of the user. So it's not permanent storage; it is a temporary storage solution. It also is something that you probably shouldn't be, storing credit cards or password type information in as well. You can use levels of encryption, but at the end of the day, it's going to be files on a user's hard drive. So keep that in mind. I mentioned this term before, this concept of what we call partitioning. I can't think really of a better name for that, but it's basically the concept of how do I take my application and put it into logical slices, or how do I make a composite or modular application? And am I taking advantage of shared resources, both human resources as well as technical resources? Is there a component or particularly a module from an existing application that I might be able to leverage. In Silverlight, we provide a couple mechanisms for this. Number one, you may have heard of, from Patterns and Practices, there was a composite application block that never fully got off its feet, I don't think, and got huge adoption. That has evolved into this project that was called Prism. Most people refer to it as Prism. I think technically the name is Composite WPF, but you'll see it referred to as Prism all over the place. And what Prism is Prism is a lot of things, but one of the great things about Prism as a framework is it enables you to partition your application in a more modular or composite application concept. So this is where I was talking about your shared resources from a human resource standpoint. Maybe you have two different teams that are both working on different aspects of your application. If you go about the Prism mechanism and thinking about them as a modular component and taking a step back and seeing your application really only as a shell that is loading different modules, then teams can work in a more isolated manner doing basically contract-driven development and working in more isolated teams and being able to use a lot more human resources to get your application completed, as well as develop modular and reusable components. Other mechanisms with regard to this concept of what we call partitioning is, with regard to a Silverlight application, your application is deployed as an XAP file or a ZAP file. which is basically when you compile the application, all your code and your assembly references get compiled into this zip file, basically, and that's what gets downloaded on the user's machine when they visit the URL for your application. And as your application grows and you add dependencies, that zap file is just going to grow as well. So you don't necessarily want to have, I should say, you really don't want to have, not don't necessarily, you don't want to have a large zap file. You know, if I put everything and all my assets in this zap file and all of a sudden my application is 50 megabytes and user goes to a URL, you know, they're waiting forever just to download the application to get to the start screen. You want to think more in logical slices even at that level as well. So even if you're not using something like Prism, take advantage of how can I segment my application. I like to think of this, one of the easiest analogies I can draw is the concept of an e-commerce workflow. So if you as an end consumer think about you're going to an e-commerce site and you're starting to, you know, you visit the site, so obviously you're at Amazon or eBay or something like that, your intent is to look for product. So it would make sense that you would start loading, you know, product catalog screens and information. But at this point, you know, just browsing product, you have not yet made an intent to purchase. So there wouldn't necessarily be a time for the application to start, you know, sending you all that shopping cart logic. I have not yet, as a consumer, made the intent to purchase. But the second I add something to my cart, that represents an intent of an action. And that's where you, as the application developer, can say, oh, okay, this user has perhaps going to purchase something now. I should, in the background, start downloading my logic for the checkout mechanism or the shopping cart, et cetera. So thinking of ways to partition your application in that way will make your application, number one, technically more efficient from just a size standpoint, as well as more modular from you as a development standpoint. So I mentioned Prism is one way of doing that. The Managed Extensibility Framework is also another way of doing that using basically packages and catalogs, they refer to them as. So you would probably want to take a look at those. The Managed Extensibility Framework, or MEF as it's called, is something relatively new to Silverlight. It actually ships in Silverlight 4, but there also it is open source and it's available on CodePlex for you to use today in your applications. The other aspect is communication, and I think perhaps this is one of the larger paradigm shifts as if your development staff is coming from a web development world. This was again, my experience, my background only being a web development world and living in this kind of server world, essentially. This was a large paradigm shift for me to really grok immediately. And so these are some of the things that you have to think about from an architecture standpoint about your communications. Most of the time, you're not connected. So if you're doing web development, this is something that's not necessarily new to you. The second bullet point, however, is probably what trips people up a little bit more, is that you don't think of anything now in your communication protocols as a synchronous manner anymore. So every communication over the wire in Silverlight world is asynchronous. So a key point in architecting your application is understanding that you now have to design for asynchronous programming, whereas before, you know, developers usually on the server world, they would, you know, add in a web reference to a web service, and, you know, line 10 they would call that web service, and line 11 they'd be able to use the, you know, return of that web service and then continue along in this application logic. Now we have this asynchronous model in Silverlight, and so you're not going to be able to design exactly for this, you know, that line-by-line code execution. You'll have event handlers and completed event handlers and delegates. And, you know, so understanding that from an architectural standpoint going into it is one of the most important things you can do. How, you know, do you have sequential calls that you'll have to manage? How are you going to manage those? You know, what is your chainer going to look like? And so, you know, these are basically some of the things that you have to look at from a communication standpoint. And the last two bullet points are things that I want to touch on. So in most RHEA platforms, Silverlight and Flash are the two most popular, and JavaFX will also fall into this. We have this concept of cross-domain rules. So what cross-domain means is that I'm an application, and let's say we usually think of Silverlight applications by what we call the site of origin. And so the site of origin is the URI of that ZAP file. So let's say my application is on foo.com/ mycalculator.zap. That becomes my site of origin. Well, let's say my calculator is using web services off of bar.com, which is another website that's providing these services. By default, any Silverlight application from its can only communicate with web services and network requests to its own site of origin. So if I had a web service on foo.com/ something service, I would be able to communicate with that client. The second I try to access a third-party service and to Silverlight, anything that's not on, in the site of origin app domain is third-party, even if it's your own company. So foo, if my application is on foo.com and I try to access, app1.foo.com, that represents a different domain to my application. And so what we see here is this concept of cross-domain coming into play. And most people, if in a correctly, kind of N-tier architecture, you'll see that you'll have a service layer, sitting somewhere else that's not in your application layer. So you will run into this. And what we have here is that rich client platforms have created this concept of these cross-domain policy files. Flash has their own format, which we actually support in a subset of that, but we prefer the format that Silverlight supports as well, and it's called the client access policy file. And this is an XML file that sits at the endpoint of the service that defines the rules of who can communicate with it from a rich client platform. So if I was the bar.com service, the calculator service, I would have a file there that says, yes, I'm going to allow foo.com to call me, or star any domain. I can say any domain can call me, or a specific domain can call me, or I can even get granular and say this specific domain can only call this verb using these headers. So you can get as granular as you want or as open as you want. But understanding that the second you have a service call that's not in the site of origin, that's a key thing in your service architecture that you'll have to understand. Except along the lines of that, exception handling is probably the other thing as well that you'll have to understand. Both networking requests are going to be using the browser's networking stack, and because of that, there's some byproducts that the browser's networking stack doesn't fully understand the complete HTTP response codes in the networking stack. So if you are expecting your service, if you're throwing fault exceptions, they will not bubble up as a fault exception to Silverlight. Silverlight will see that as an HTTP 404 error. Now the response code, the response stream itself will actually show the responses, but you can't reliably, just by default, count on your fault exceptions to bubble up. In Silverlight 3, we actually have mechanisms for you, especially if you're using WCF on the server side, Windows Communication Foundation, on the server side, and you're using custom exceptions or fault exceptions, there's a configuration you can do on the server side that will enable you to have those fault exceptions bubble up. So those are some of the key things that that you should understand from a communication standpoint. Data. So obviously any application is going to use data, most likely. Data can be, again, if you're a casual game, data is your scoring mechanism. Line of business application, data is your database. There's plenty of choices. I think Microsoft does a good job of providing too many choices of things. In Silverlight, we support really any type of data architecture. I did mention before that almost all communication in Silverlight is going to be through a service layer, though. So your service-oriented architecture is key to your Silverlight application. But in that, your services could be ASP.NET services, so ASMX services, as well as any SOAP services or REST-based services or plain old XML. So we kind of support the gamut of these different types of services. If you're using a SOAP-based service or really anything that's a discoverable service, you'll be able to, in your development experience, you'll be able to just kind of do the add service reference. get a strongly typed generated proxy and be able to develop code off of that. Now, again, any of these services is always going to be asynchronous as well. So even though you're not developing your service for an you may not have developed your ASP.NET web service, for an example, using an async pattern, when you're using it in Silverlight, it will be an async pattern. So understand that. Understanding who owns the endpoint, again, that cross-domain that I just mentioned. If you're the owner of the endpoint, what is your policy going to look like to get people to opt in and enable that that application to run or to call the services, excuse me? What are any authorization rules and what authentication mechanisms are you using in your data? Is it protected at the service layer? What kind of type of role authentication are you using for that? So again, architecting your services to accommodate these type of rules is an important thing to understand. And then of course, you have the situation of I have an investment already in this existing service. It has this strong type. How can I take advantage of this in Silverlight and get some code sharing between my service that I already have existing, perhaps my Windows Forms application that is using that service already, and now I want to provide a Silverlight client application that's using this service as well. One of the things you can do is a feature in Visual Studio is what's called code linking. So when you add a file to your projects, you can actually add it as a link rather than a hard file. So it actually uses the compiler for the project appropriate compiler. So if you're using a Silverlight application, it would use the MS build tasks for Silverlight versus WPF, etc. But if you have basically simple class representations, you can have a, usually what people do is for kind of code sharing is they'll create a project that has their class definitions and then link to those code definitions from other projects. There also is in Prism, which I mentioned before, there's a project linker a utility that's a Visual Studio tool that will also help you kind of do some of this as well. But again, these are kind of things of, where does my data already exist and how can I reuse it across the different applications. Someone is asking a question, Jeff's asking, can you expand upon the mechanisms for authorization from services? Sure. So out of the box, Silverlight itself isn't necessarily providing any type of authentication or authorization mechanism. If you recall the architecture of Silverlight, whereas the application is really hosted in some type of web instance from the start, there's a couple things that we do there. So if, let's say Silverlight's hosted in an ASP.NET application, and your ASP.NET application uses Windows integrated authentication, that authentication and that information becomes a part of any future network request. So once the Silverlight application is loaded, we're using the authentication information from the page that is from the app and the page that is hosting that Silverlight application. Alternatively, if you are using ASP.NET on the back end, you can use ASP.NET's authentication and membership systems. They are exposable via web services themselves, so there's a configuration switch that you can do on ASP.NET to say expose application services for authentication and expose application services for membership. And those become service endpoints that Silverlight can call. So you can start doing things like, is user in role and those type of things. And there's also some frameworks that I'll talk about in a moment that will make this easier actually right now. One of the things that we released to assist kind of the combination of getting the best of ASP.NET from a server architecture and WCF, as well as productivity and the best of client development is, something we released called WCF RIA Services. Now you may have seen it up until prior to last week referred to as .NET RIA Services. We went through a flight product renaming this last week at PDC, so it's formally now called WCF RIA Services. If you see people who refer to .NET RIA services or just RIA services in general, it's one and the same. And I'm not going to read the slide. You're welcome to read it. This is kind of the marketing pitch here. Here I'll put up this is my my layman's pitch here. The gist of the renaming of WCF RIA services is to stress the importance that the services that you create using this framework are in fact full fidelity Windows Communication Foundation services. So while you may be using RIA services for Silverlight development, that service that you create is also able to be consumed by your WinForms application, by your ASP.NET application, by your Windows service, by your WPF application. Or perhaps you need a different specific binding from within the firewall that you want to use a TCP binary channel for some reason. Again, the service is exposed, you would just add that channel to it. You wouldn't have to create a new service. So that's really important to note, is that the services you create are in fact WCF services. At its core, RIA services is two things. It's a server framework as well as kind of a Visual Studio tooling effort as well. And perhaps this would be a good demo to show once we complete the presentation, is that you would create what we call a domain service, which is, again, is basically a WCF REST service based off of some type of a model. Now, we provide a couple modeling techniques for you, like Link to SQL or the Entity Framework. Entity Framework is probably what most people will use, but if you also have nHibernate or some type of other ORM model, you could use those as well. But your domain service basically exposes that model and functions that you define as services. Now, in Silverlight, if I was just using a SOAP service or a typical REST endpoint, I would have to have a service reference. I'd get a strongly typed generated proxy. Everything would still be asynchronous, so I would say, you know, create new SOAP client, call this function, call this completed event handler, but I'd have to make sure that I would have that service reference. In contrast as well, if I was using a typical REST endpoint, I would use something like the web client library and just say, you know, call a post or a GET request to this URI, get the result, which might be a stream or a string or some type of object, and, you know, rehydrate it or just use the value, et cetera. One of the things that RIA services aims to do is project that object model that you're defining on your server side onto the client. So if I have an employees object on my server domain service, I have an employees object in my Silverlight application. And from a developer standpoint, I'm not really saying add service reference. I'm not saying create new web client. I'm basically saying, you know, my domain service dot employees. And so it becomes a little bit more readable in the code standpoint, a little bit more productive from a developer standpoint, and familiar. That projection, that kind of projecting onto the Silverlight application, that is kind of where the Visual Studio trick comes into play, because it is in the build task of a RIA service project that it actually generates the Silverlight generated code for you. Let's finish up a couple of these, and then perhaps we'll go into a demo if we have time here. You can actually get more information on, and there's a link on this as well, for RIA services if you go to silverlight.net/RIA services, and there's some walkthroughs as well. So a couple more buckets of talking about architecting a Silverlight application. Security obviously is always going to be key. I mentioned that, you know, how the authentication works within Silverlight. You know, we use the authentication mechanism of the hosting HTML container. You can also use, you know, direct authentication with things like ASP.NET authentication mechanisms. Things like Windows Identity Foundation or codename Geneva that have just been coming out we don't have a completely finished story on how we're going to interoperate with Windows Identity Foundation or Geneva at this point. There are some things that you can do. Typically, most of these things are going to be brokering something in between at this point until Silverlight can get the support that it needs to do the necessary communication with certificates and kind of the more stringent WS security implications. We also often only think of security as authentication and authorization, but talking about, you know, securing your actual intellectual property. And, you know, I mentioned that you compile your .NET application, it gets put into this ZAP file, which you can rename to .zip, and you'll see the contents of it. It is a ZIP file. And that gets downloaded to the user's machine. So any tech-savvy user would be able to look in their temporary internet files, grab the SAP file, unzip it, and see the contents, and you'll see .NET code there. Now, as we know, .NET code is, unless you're obfuscating it, is, you know, reflectable, for lack of a better term, using tools like Reflector or Salamander and these other types of tools that can kind of decompile or deconstruct the MSIL to actually view the code. So one mechanism of security in your application is thinking about, you know, do I need to protect my IP through things like obfuscation? Because Silverlight is .NET code, you can use the same obfuscation mechanism. So there are the big vendors of obfuscation are still they still work. So in Visual Studio 2010, .Obfuscator is still shipped as a part of the included tool set. But there are also other vendors provided as well. Some that come to mind are the DeepSea Obfuscator, and SmartAssembly is one of the more popular ones as well. These tools work. They obfuscate the .NET code, and it still, you know, it still runs. The one thing to note is that XAML itself is not able to be obfuscated at this point. So while you may be protecting your logic IP, you still need to be concerned about, you know, or you may want to be concerned about, you know, what in your XAML code is open for interpretation or theft or whatnot. You can think of XAML as kind of like the view source of the web world, right? So, you know, unless you're doing something to obfuscate your HTML, it's kind of the same type of thing. XAML represents your presentation layer. There are ways that you can go about protecting your XAML by not including it in your XAP and doing dynamic loading up from the server side, et cetera. Other aspects of security, these last three bullet points are, you know, general software development guidelines that still apply within Silverlight. So validating user input, we actually provide mechanisms for a validation framework in Silverlight that does both the client as well as server-side validation for, you know, if your model is annotated, to have validation rules, very similar to ASP.NET, where validation can occur on the client using whatever, you know, stringent rules that you have, regular expressions, custom validation, et cetera. And that bubbles back down to the client as well. Logging mechanisms, most people are using isolated storage as kind of a logging mechanism for when exceptions happen or when you know, you need some feedback with regard to the application. But securing those logs as well is something that you'll want to look at. The standard .NET cryptography APIs exist in Silverlight. I would caution you that there usually people say, I need private public key encryption in isolated storage. And my question to you would be, what are you storing in isolated storage that you think is, you know, is really secure? As we mentioned before, that it's, you know, it's a temporary location, the user's in control, you know, it is a file on the machine, et cetera. So understanding whatever cryptography needs you have, both whether it's actual cryptography or just simple things as far as SSL communication across the wire for your application. So Christoph has a question about obfuscation. Is obfuscation really a practical best practice? Obfuscation in the languages I'm used to has always been seen as not a real solution. It just slows hackers down. It doesn't provide meaningful protection. Is .NET any different? Absolutely. I mean, obfuscation is exactly what it says. It's not complete protection, right? It is. I don't know if it's a best practice in every application. I think it depends on your needs. If you look at the .NET code, for example, it's not obfuscated. We protect our intellectual property through patents and copyrights versus any type of technical implementation. But obfuscation, I think, is a good deterrent. Some people say, you know, it's like putting the home security sign in front of your house without having an alarm system. I guess that's one way of looking at it. But if there is some things, you know, if you're a component vendor and you don't want people to decompile your code and figure out what you're doing or whatnot, obfuscation is a low-hanging fruit opportunity for you to protect your code from decompilation. Some of the providers do it very well. Some of them don't do it very well. But you know, if you're trying to protect from that person basically loading up the assembly in Reflector and seeing what the logic is. Most obfuscators will give you the ability to do that. So I think that's one of those situations where it depends on the needs of your particular application. So lastly, the user experience concept is, I mentioned that, you know, we're talking about it last year, but perhaps it's the most important. It's usually often the most overlooked aspect of an application, but it's critical to your application success. And user experience is not just about color palettes and telling a designer to make it look better. It really is about how are your users interacting with the data, with the system. A good example is a lot of applications have been developed that follow the kind of Outlook user interface from a corporate standpoint. And there's a reason for that. You know, if you're behind the firewall and people are using Microsoft Outlook, they're familiar with those semantics of how that application works and how the user is going to interact with that data. So providing the accordion and the ribbon style framework in your application, you know, people are seeing that, are doing that intentionally because they know that this is an experience that brings familiarity to the user versus, you know, all of a sudden putting your navigation on the right side of your application. You know, is that going to confuse your users? So it's not just about user experience is not just about user interface, but also the interaction of the data, of how the user is going to use the system, what that dashboard is going to look like, where the critical points of information are displayed, how they're displayed, how our alerts are displayed, and understanding, you know, that is critical to the success of your application. If you don't have a user experience person on your team, I would consider it, consider outsourcing that. Bring these people in early so that they can help you identify these usability aspects, you know, who are your users, how they're going to use it. I'm amazed at how many applications get developed without people actually asking the users how they're going to use the system or doing usability studies and watching people work. You know, a simple hour watching a customer service agent over the shoulder of how they use their application today does wonders of how you can develop your application for the future. And again, we mentioned updates as well. How will updates be shipped? How will users be alerted of updates? And you know, what will that experience look like as far as when an update to your application occurs? You know, if it's subtle updates, maybe you don't care. But if it's a new significant feature, you know, how will you present that new feature to the user if it's something that they don't readily use? So the importance of user experience cannot be stressed enough. It's usually often overlooked in corporate environments because it's a role that typically hasn't been leveraged quite a bit. You know, we have a lot of battleship gray applications, and that may be perfectly acceptable to your organization, and there's completely nothing wrong with that. But we've seen over time that introducing better practices in user experience and really understanding how users are interacting with your applications results in higher productivity of your employees, better validity of the data, you know, less errors, et cetera, and a more streamlined process in your application development and less iterations of changes and things like that. So those are some of the key aspects that I'd like to call out in regard to architecting your application. Again, so talking about deployment and security and data and communication, user experience and authentication mechanisms, et cetera. As we kind of wind down here, from a tool standpoint, from a Silverlight world and a XAML development world, these are kind of the tools of the trade to leverage. These are best of breed tools, of course. You know, just like with anything .NET, all you need is a Notepad and a compiler, and you'll be good. I think you'd be crazy to do it that way, but you're more than welcome to. But Visual Studio and Expression Studio, and for team collaboration, you know, source control integration, work item tracking, etc., leveraging Team Foundation Server, these are kind of the best of breed tools for Microsoft development. Visual Studio is the kind of more developer experience for Silverlight development. This is where you'll do a lot of your XAML coding and from an actual XML standpoint, as well as most of your .NET development. Expression Blend is a tool that I best describe as a visual designer for XAML. So whereas Visual Studio doesn't have the best experience for doing things like animation and layout and templating your application. Expression Blend absolutely does, and that's what it's intended for. So it's a great design surface. It's usually intended for more of your interaction designer or your interactive developer to work with. Both of those tools share the same project structure. So from a dev lead or an architect lead standpoint, they're the same. They can open the same solution structure. They use the same source control, et cetera. I've mentioned a couple tools like Prism and things like that. A lot of things that you may also want to consider is what are your patterns for development? And there are some, there's basically kind of three patterns that I've seen emerge in XAML development that really, I say emerge, but these are just exist. These are patterns, development patterns that have existed forever, right? You can go the monolithic approach, which is basically, I've got my application, I've got XAML files, I've got code behind files, and they just work, and that's how it is. And I kind of use that code behind approach. There's nothing wrong with that. It's probably not going to suit every application. As with any of these patterns, there's nothing wrong with using any of them. Not any one of these is going to fit every need. So understand that these are just patterns that you can choose. The most popular in the XAML world lately is this model view model pattern, or what also people consider call the presentation model pattern. You'll see that in Silverlight as we evolve our framework, that we will be evolving our framework to fit this more view model approach from a pattern development standpoint. And as well, you'll see a lot of toolkits emerge for creating XAML applications. So like WPF built on top of this pattern. I noted two of these right here. XAML Power Toys is a Visual Studio plugin that's extremely helpful in creating forms-based applications in XAML, as well as creating view models for your application. Additionally, the MVVM Lite toolkit from one of our Silverlight MVPs, Laurent, is a great lightweight toolkit to explore if you're new to the view model pattern and you want to kind of use a jumpstart framework to look at. Prism is often confused as only a view model pattern. As I mentioned before, Prism is much more than any one thing, actually. It's a composite application model. It's a modular model. It does use presentation model in some aspects. It's a application partitioning model, but don't draw the analogy that Prism equals view model. I think that's the wrong analogy to draw. So of some of these frameworks I mentioned, so that WCF RIA services that we covered, that I mentioned, all the information is available there at silverlight.net/RIA services. Last week, we just released an update for that for both Visual Studio 2008 as well as Visual Studio 2010. Prism is the composite application framework, and there's a link in the slide deck. I also mentioned the Managed Extensibility Framework. You'll see to refer to as MEF, which is another kind of extensibility point that you may consider for your applications that can help in partitioning your application as well as leveraging MEF as a starting point to make sure that your application is extensible. The last two are actually third-party solutions that are frameworks to help you develop applications. Both of these actually work well with the view model pattern. DevForce is a product from a company called IdeaBlade, and Caliburn is actually an open source project that's available in CodePlex. Both of these are great frameworks to explore. DevForce actually has been around for a while. If you may actually be using it in your WinForms or WPF applications. They have a Silverlight capability now as well. So these are just some things that I think you should explore if you're new to Silverlight and be able to look at these different types of frameworks and how they're going about approaching Silverlight application architecture and development separately. And then lastly, just some resources that I wanted to call out. Patterns and Practices has an application architecture guide. It's available at this URL there. A lot of what I just talked about goes a little bit more in depth in this Patterns and Practices architecture guide. Myself and a couple others actually contributed to the RIA section of this guide. This guide is not just about RIA application development. It's much broader than that. I actually think just last week it went to physical print, so you can get it online as a PDF, or you can actually buy the book from Patterns and Practices. One of the sections in there is RIA development from an architect's viewpoint, and a lot of the concepts that I just discussed go a little bit more in depth in there as well. There's a link to some Silverlight books that you might want to take a look at. One of the key architects for the Silverlight runtime, Ashraf Mikhail, wrote a book called Essential Silverlight 3, which I think includes some good, what he calls, under-the-hood sections, and I think it's one of the only books that has these particular kind of gotchas and, you know, here's the things you need to know about rendering from an architectural standpoint so that you can maximize performance, et cetera. So just some resources for you. As always, you know, happy to reach, you know, you feel free to reach out to me at any standpoint. Let me see if I can get back to my contact information quickly here. I'm not sure as I navigate through this, but that was the extent of what I wanted to share with you today. Joe, I don't know if we have any questions in the queue, but if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them at this time.
Sure. So the one thing, one of the questions that did come up I want to point out to folks is there was a question about what's new in Silverlight 4 and whether, you know, kind of a quick intro into what are some of the new things. It's a fairly large topic, so one of the things that I'd recommend you do is if you're interested in what's coming with Silverlight 4, Tim has a, I would almost call it the reference blog post of all that's new. If you hit his blog, it's about the fourth post down, goes through what's new with Silverlight 4, and there's plenty of detail there if you're interested in that. So that was one of the questions. Another question that came up was any guidance on when to use things like Prism versus the .NET RIA services? So I'm kind of curious about your perspective on that, Tim.
Yeah, that's a good question. And like I said, you know, similar to data access, right? You know, when do you use ADO.NET versus ODBC? And I think there's a lot of choice that's provided. I don't think any one choice is going to be wrong all of the time. You know, the good consultant answer, of course, is it depends. But I think if you're starting out in a new application, I really think that you should give something like RIA services a solid look at. Because of the underlying architecture being WCF, from a service-oriented architecture standpoint, it seems to make sense that you would want to make sure that your service endpoint, you know, is WCF. And getting the benefits of what RIA services provides from an application model for Silverlight as also, you know, maintaining those benefits of WCF proper on the server side enables you kind of an extensible model on the server side to reuse those investments and services. So from that perspective, I would make sure that you look at RIA services. Again, from what Prism is less about a particular framework but more about attacking the problem of composite applications. So, you know, can you use Prism with RIA services? Absolutely. They're aiming to solve two different problems, actually. So I don't think it's an either or. I think where you would see kind of an either or is something like, you know, do you use RIA services versus something like IdeaBlade's DevForce, right? In some areas, they fundamentally differ on how they're going about attacking developing applications. And again, I personally don't believe one is more right than the other. Both warrant a good look at. And at the end of the day, you're going to have to choose the right tool for your job. You know, what is the skill set for your developers? What investments may you already have in existing frameworks? What problems you're trying to solve, right? So if you are trying to solve composite applications, then Prism might be a good look at. You know, if I need my application to be extensible, make sure you take a look at Meth. But comparing Prism to RIA services is probably not a good thing because they can, you know, they're both solving two different problems.